having it cut off. Then, you know, buying through phony or friendly corporations so as to conceal real destinations of shipments is another way to get secure distribution. At least, it's not necessarily secure in that sense, but it's secure against intentional attack against you. It may be attacking the other guy and you accidentally get hit with the side effects. Secure key management. This is not so easy to do, but physical keys, for example, there are physical key audits and anti-duplication mechanisms and periodic rekeying of locks. Common practice. Public key and automated key generation and distribution systems, and then analysis of physical traits on keys for integrity verification. Okay? So, for example, you can not only have the key is in this physical form on this smart card, but I can physically verify that this is the same smart card that I put the key on before. So when you add physical to informational, it improves things. Although current key distribution systems are not very good, in fact. Locks are used to prevent unauthorized entry while permitting authorized entry. For example, mechanical locks, magnetic locks, electronic locks, password checkers are locks. Time-based locks, use-based locks, environment-based locks, event-based locks, and combinations of these things. And you know, the locking technology has been evolving for, well, certainly several thousand years. And the ideas and the realizations can get very fancy. And they can be as general as, you know, as complex as general computational complexity. Mechanical locks have undergone substantial improvement in the last 20 years. But it's very expensive to get really high-quality mechanical locks. And really expert pickers know how to pick even the best mechanical locks. And in fact, no, I don't want to tell you that one. But maybe next course. Secure our trusted channels. For example, you can use trusted channel between a user and an operating system, which is required for a trusted computing base, right? If you want to have a trusted computing base, you need to have some way for the user to hit a key on the keyboard and identify that they're connected to the computer and that nobody's put something in the wire in between them, okay? Cryptographically secure communications channels are used in a wide variety of circumstances to provide some sort of trusted channel. And then there are physically secure communications paths. You can use limited functions. So what you do here is you don't give them Turing capability. No macros in my word processor, please. If you could turn off word macros, you would eliminate probably 50% of the viruses spreading in the world today, right? Not the different variants, but 50% of the actual infected files. Because these things spread through email over the internet so effectively that they're taken over. So, for example, you can have limited function interface to systems. I mean, your wristwatch. Right? There's general purpose computer in there probably somewhere, but sound of a gun, you really can't, you know, do much to program it from those three buttons on your wrist. Although, if you hold down one and three at the same time and tap on two, I understand eventually you can get control. But, you know, this HP, used to be an HP calculator that you could. It wasn't put as HP 45, was it, or 41, 45. And there was a combination of keys. You could hold down like four or five keys at one time that would get you into the processor, and you could actually program the processor, and you could do all sorts of stuff.
41C.
The 41C, there you go. Thank you. See? Wisdom, true wisdom comes from experience. Special purpose devices that perform only specific functions dictated by their designs. For example, my secure ID only does what it does. I'm unaware of any way to reprogram my secure ID to predict the outcome of baseball games. And then there are special devices that are designed to fail-safe under attempts to use them for other than their intended purposes. And as an example, what's a good example of a fail-safe? Well, can't think of any right off the top of my head. Anybody have any good examples of fail-safe devices? IBM makes a crypto box that when you try to open it, it self-destructs. The Abyss processor was the first version of this. Yeah, so if you enter it, it'll kill the power and knock out its memory of the keys, for example. And it makes it harder to recover them. What? What are?
Smart
ID cards are supposed to be. Fortessa, there you go. Fortessa is. Fortessa. It's been shown that systems with even a very limited set of functions can be used to implement general purpose systems. For example, a NOR gate is enough NOR gates and I can build any computer that can exist. So, it's not that easy to get limited function. And lots of people have tried to make limited function interfaces like for the Unix shell and stuff. I encountered one at some fairly substantial financial institution where one of the functions that it permitted in the interface was Kermit. So I said, oh, take me into Kermit, and then I typed exclamation mark, enter, and it gave me a shell prompt, and I proceeded to type a copy of the database containing the salary figures for all the executives out. And when I handed it to them, they expressed that that might be one of the ways that their salary figures are leaking out. So in practice, limited functions are not always that easy to obtain, especially in a general purpose computer, which is one of the problems that we have in our world. Limited sharing is used to prevent unfettered information flow, which we're all trying to accomplish, I guess. The Bell-Lapadula security model, the Bibe integrity model, Deming's lattice model, and my POSET model are all methods for doing that, but there's a fundamental problem. The fundamental problem is that we're trying to share everything. Limited transitivity. You can limit the ability of information flow to go more than a certain distance, perhaps in hops, for example. A can go to B or B can go to C, but something you send from A to B is not allowed to be passed on to C. That would be a limited transitivity. There are no practical systems that do this today, as far as I'm aware. So I thought I'd mention it because it's in my list of 140. Disabling unsafe features. Features known to be unsafe are disabled. Okay, this is not rocket science. Like, just don't allow network file systems to operate over the internet, for example, unless it's a secured one somehow. Disabling guest accounts. Under Windows NT, you might want to disable guest accounts, since the default is guest accounts, and I've walked into NT boxes everywhere and just sat down and logged in as guest with no password, and then proceeded to go out into the internet to telnet into my site, which is a very handy feature, unless you maybe don't want people doing that. Disabling dial-in modems connected to maintenance ports, except when maintenance is required. This is unsafe, okay? And there's no reason to do it. You can't always disable those features, but if you can, you should. Authenticated information. So you authenticate information as the source, content, and other factors of import. For example, authenticated electronic mail systems based on public key cryptography, source authentication to give you secure channels based on information related to individuals, and the use of third-party certification to authenticate information are all effective ways. When they talk about authenticated information, they're talking generally about authenticating that the source was who it is asserted to be, that the information is that was received is the same as that which was sent, or suitability for purpose, or correspondence to reality. Okay, all four of those are things that we might want to authenticate, and there are various ways to do that. Integrity checking. So there are various ways to assure the integrity of information, people, systems, and devices. Detailed analysis of code, change detection with cryptographic checksums, in-depth testing, syntax and consistency verification, and verification of information through independent means. These are all examples of ways that you can get integrity. There's apparently a fundamental limitation in that if you cannot, let's see, the whole basis of taking input is that there's more than one possibility that could be right. So unless we eliminate that, there's always the possibility that we'll get the wrong input instead of the right one. Infrastructure-wide digging hotlines. Anybody know the magic 800 number hotline for infrastructure? If you're going to dig a hole somewhere, what number do you dial? What? Missed utility. 1-800-0-NO? No. I think it's Cable USA or USA Cable or something like that throughout the United States. Yeah, I didn't get a chance to verify the number, but there's an infrastructure hotline. You dial the number before you dig. Okay? Note the before word as opposed to that afterward. That's after you get electrocuted, after you incur your $100,000 in penalties. One of the issues here is that this requires tracking all infrastructure elements and introduces substantial risk from this gathered and co-located information. If I want to disrupt the infrastructure, what I do is I get to the database and that tells me just the right places to hit, have maximum effect. These two-edged swords, tough, aren't they? Conservative resource allocation, you allocate resources so as to ensure that anything that is started can be completed with the allocated amount of resources. So you prevent denial of services and guarantee that something started is completed. Examples include over-specification to assure that operational compliance, pre-allocation of all the required memory for processing and computer operating systems, or static allocation rather than dynamic allocation in the telecommunication system. Turns out, in order to do this, we need to pay a lot more for our computers. As I mentioned earlier, what we do when we design things is we design them so that they have enough for the 99% of the time case, or the 90% of the time case, depending on, you know, whether we're AT&T or MCI or who. Okay? So what you do is you make it so that only in the rarest of circumstances will we have not enough memory to fulfill all the requests. The problem is that as an attacker, hey, I'm trying to get to that rare circumstance. And it's pretty easy to get to the rare circumstance if you induce it intentionally, whereas by accident it's unlikely to happen. So all these techniques that work against accidents are really terrible against malicious attackers because, son of a gun, if they don't, you know, run that command 15 times in a row. By accident, you would never run the same command 15 times in a row, randomly selecting commands. But intentionally, it's a very easy thing to do. Fire suppression equipment, like halon gas, I guess is no longer allowed, right? You can use water, fire extinguishers, dumping capability, and this sort of stuff. This is off-the-shelf stuff for fire suppression. There's another kind of fire suppression, that's where you shoot back. It's a different kind of fire, but it works. And it works in the information domain. And if you come to my DCA talk, I'll give you a real good example of it, but there's just not enough time to tell you the fun story here. And then there's fire limiting things like asbestos suits and armor and fire doors and firewalls and this sort of off-the-shelf stuff. So you can suppress it. You can limit where it can go to. There's concealment. They talk about security through obscurity. This is it. You conceal services, so only those who know how to do it can do it. For example, secret hallways with trick doors. And menu items that don't appear on the menu, and programs that don't appear on listings, but operate when properly called. It's commonly referred to as security through obscurity because the effectiveness of the protection is based on a lack of knowledge by the attackers. It's generally held to be very weak, except in special circumstances, because it's hard to keep a secret about such things, and because such things are often found out by clever attackers, and because insiders who have special knowledge are very often the reason that systems are attacked. As the 60-80% of the attacks come from insiders who know where the secret doorway is. Traps are devices that are used to capture an intruder or retain their interest while additional information about them is obtained. For example, man traps, I've mentioned before, used to capture people who are trying to illicitly enter or more often exit a facility. It's much more fun to catch them on the way out because then they have the goods. But on the way in, oh, I just turned left, I should have turned right. On the way out, you turned right but you have a stereo in your hand. Computer traps are used to entice attackers to remain online while they're traced, and special physical barriers are designed to trap devices that are used to bypass controls. And there's no theory, as far as I'm aware, of traps. Content checking. This is where we verify the content within normal specifications to detect particular content. For example, Verify parameter values for operating systems. Examine inbound disks and tapes for proper content. That is, this is supposed to be an update to Microsoft Windows. Does this look like a Windows update disk, or you know, what is this? Real-time detection of known attack patterns. In a limited function system, content checking is fairly easy to do. That is, all you have to do is be able to differentiate between correct and incorrect values. But in systems with unlimited functions, most of the key things we want to verify about content are typically undecidable. Okay, so content checking in a limited function system is relatively easy. In a general purpose system where we're allowing you to download programs from over the internet and run them on your PC, it's really difficult to make sure that those programs are good, even if you use Java. Or drink Java, I don't know. You have to drink a lot of Java to use Java reliably. Trusted systems. It's a whole class of systems whose designs are made to meet some set of standards, not only their design, but their implementation and hopefully their operation. So for example, you have systems and components approved by certification bodies and under published criteria. For example, there's the ISO OSI standard. That always confuses me. The ISO OSI standard, which includes a security standard as a substandard of the standard standard. It is a substandard security standard, by the way. Then there is the ITSEC standard, which is marginally the global standard. And then there's the US standard, the TCPS, whatever standard. And then there's a lot of these trusted system standards out there. And standard implementations are used for a particular purpose with a particular orientation and seem to work reasonably well. They tend to have more effective protection mechanisms than the less standard and non-certified systems, but the aura of legitimacy is sometimes unjustified. The certification process typically introduces substantial delays and complexities, and while you get these economies of scale, you also have large delays and expense, which is why most people don't bother to do it. For example, everybody's heard Windows NT, right, is C2 certified. So first of all, C2 certified is not very good. Okay, C2 certified doesn't, for example, when they find a bug, they don't have to fix it to be C2 certified. Okay, another thing about C2 certified, C2 certified in a non-networking configuration without a floppy disk. Okay, anybody here have an NT system without a floppy disk that's not on a network? Well, it's not certified under those conditions, and it's not secure under those conditions. So you got to be careful because certification only tells you specific things. And if you treat it as the end-all, then you're missing the end-all. Perception management, just as it's used for attack, can be used for defense. For example, the appearance of tight security tends to reduce the number of attacks in many environments, as opposed to the challenging of people to attack your site. That's different than the appearance of tight security. Creating the perception that people who attack a particular system will be caught in order to deter their attack, that works really well. You know, ever since I moved to a national lab, almost nobody ever tries to attack my system. We used to have lots of people trying to attack my system, but man, I moved to that national lab and they see the .gov and they say, you know, I just don't want those guys coming to visit me at my house as FBI guys when I break into these, you know, government facilities. It's different. So that works, that perception. Making people believe that a particularly vulnerable target is not valuable reduces the number of people that are going to go after it. It's just like low-profile buildings, right? Same thing. It's always tricky trying to fool an opponent into doing what you want them to do. So remember, if you don't fool them, then you are the one that they call the fool. Generally, deceptions, same camouflage, false planted information, ruses, displays, demonstrations, feints, lies, and insight are available defensive techniques. Facades used to misdirect attackers as to the content of a system. False claims that a facility or system is watched by law enforcement authorities. I really like to use that one. That's my favorite. The law is going to get you. Trojan horses planted in software that is downloaded from a site. Okay? That's like, we have software on this site, but you're not supposed to be able to download it. So when you download it, we're going to download it with a Trojan horse, and it's going to blow up in your system. Okay? Now, note, liability. Note, liability. Retaining confidentiality of security status information A lot of people believe that, you know, if people actually knew the status of your system all the time, that would be very bad for you, because there are always these short periods of time when you're really insecure for one reason or another. So if you don't let them know that, then they won't know that now's the time to try attack number 37. So like not revealing specific weaknesses in specific systems is a real good idea. Until you fix it. And you reveal it to make sure the vendor fixes it. Right? Keeping information on where items are purchased. Confidential, right? You don't tell people where you buy stuff, because then they know where to plant stuff. And not detailing internal procedures to outsiders. Okay? And a lot of people call this security through obscurity. It's called operation security. There's a tendency to use weaker protection techniques than are appropriate under the assumption that nobody will figure it out. You shouldn't use weaker techniques than necessary, but at the same time, you shouldn't give the attacker information that might be helpful. Fail-safe. Designed in such a way that if they fail in a certain way, they'll fail in a safe mode. Password lockouts that activate on successive fail login attempts, except against systems administrative accounts. Here's a misspelling. Okay, yeah, two, right in there. Okay, so what's the fail-safe here is that it doesn't lock out systems administrative accounts. Okay, otherwise they just try and guess the password of the systems administrator three times, and the systems administrator can't get in to fix the password problem to let them in again. So. If you don't do it properly, normally you shouldn't allow the systems administrator to log in except from a physical location, and it shouldn't indicate that there's a difference between a failed user ID and a failed password in a login process. Yeah, well. So, what, you're saying NT is insecure? Oh, that's news.
NT will tell you, unfortunately, if they're locked out.
Yes, NT tells you that you're locked out as opposed to it's the wrong password as opposed to whatever. I mean, NT, you know, have you seen the red button attack? The red button attack. Only because, yeah, it's loaded, you download it off the internet. It's called red button. I think we have a copy of my thing. Yeah, and it comes up with a red button. And you push the red button, it makes sure that you have to tell which IP address. And it'll go in and it'll tell you everything that you can remotely mount, and what the system user is on this remote system. And oh, in most of the experiments I've done, let's see, what's the name of the different, first of all, the graphic is really nice. It rolls a bowling ball down the line towards a brick wall, and then the brick wall falls down, and then the two computers are hooked up and smiling at each other. The graphics are neat. But in addition, it'll tell you, for example, that you can remotely mount $5 or something like that. I can't imagine that would be worth remotely mounting, but you can remotely mount typically the hard disk and the systems administration area, and there's something that keeps all the keys for NT, which is the registry or something? The registry. So very often you can remotely mount the registry, you know, modify, you know, like this. I mean, it's ridiculous. But the red button, the nice thing about the red button attack is when you first run it, it asks you whether you're going to use it for evil purposes, and if you say yes, it stops. If you say no, then it runs. Yes, NT is not secure. And the newer version of NT is less secure than the previous version, by all reports. Fail-safe. So password lockouts, hardware devices that fail open circuit to prevent cascade failures, for example, and gracefully degrading systems that degrade only services that are not operating properly. The thing is, what's safe depends on the application. For example, safe condition for dynamically unstable passenger aircraft controller is probably the controller still runs. Okay? What's safe for a nuclear bomb is probably don't blow up. Okay? So in one case, you want things to keep going, and in the other case, you want things to stop. So what it means to fail safe depends on what is safe in the particular circumstance for the particular system. So there's no universal fail-safe design. Fail-safe is a function of the specifics. Independent computer and tool use by auditors. So the auditor comes in and uses the same computer he's auditing to do the audit. Guess what? The guy planted a Trojan horse, but produces the correct audit trails even though he broke in. So you, like for example, remove disks from the system under review and review them on a separate computer, or bootstrap the system from auditor-provided startup media, or the review of external information fed into and generated by the system under review are all ways that you can have your audit independent of the system under audit. Standby equipment, redundant devices are used to assure against systemic faults. For example, UPS's hot and cold standby, offsite recovery facilities, and end modular redundancy. This is common practice, and if you're not doing it in some form, you better be. Protection of the data used in system testing. Okay? Typically, if you can't test for everything, if you tell me what you're going to test for, now I know what to avoid or what to forge when you test for my attack. So you need to protect that to prevent the attackers from understanding the limits of your test. Chinese walls. All right, two here is from the financial industry. Anybody? One, two, three. Who knows what a Chinese wall is? No, it's not related to Microsoft efforts, as far as I can tell. No, a Chinese wall is used in the financial industry to prevent traders, for example, from gaining access to future planning of insider information, right? Because the trader has to be independent of the financial auditors auditing a company whose stock is being traded. Otherwise, the insider information passes back and forth. And that's right. The Chinese walls are an implementation of it. Need to know separation in shared computing bases and access control in some firewall environments. Environments are all examples of Chinese walls. Interesting paper coming out in Computers and Security on an implementation of Chinese walls in Unix using Unix access controls plus a set of logic transformations to dynamically have Chinese walls so it can figure out over time who can access what based on what they've accessed before. Oh, wow. NP complete. Oh, wow. But it works. Tracking, correlation, and analysis of incident reporting and response information. Basically, you get incidents. If you don't correlate the information, you can't tell if something's happening. Otherwise, you have a bunch of independent incidents, and they just don't seem to mean anything. For example, you can analyze for patterns of abuse, detect a change in threat profiles, detect low-rate attacks, both threshold type attacks, detect increased overall attack levels. You can improve your response performance based on feedback from the analysis process. And you can collect and reuse diagnostic and repair information to make your repair process more efficient. It's not usually done very well. It can be somewhat complex depending on what you're trying to derive from it. You want to minimize the copies of sensitive information because when you have more copies, then it's easier for somebody to get one. Numbering and tracking of all sensitive information is a widely used technique. For example, there's an example of video tags used to identify illicit copies of movies. Okay, you take low order bits of the video signal and XOR them with your cryptographic key, for a simple example, and that allows you with the key associated with who you sold it to. And that allows you to track whether that sales process produce these illegal copies that are out in the field. Okay, it's sort of like tagants that they use on explosives. Right, they put in a signature to detect it later. Handling requirements for confidential documents in many environments require the numbering and tracking of all the information, and authentication used in currency and magnetic stripe cards. It's not real expensive. It's not real complex. If the item you're protecting is worth it. You want to have independent control of the audit information. So, for example, when you take an audit trail on a computer system, you'd like to immediately transmit it somewhere else rather than retain it inside the computer system so that if there's an attack on the system, they can't mess up the audit trails and make it look like they weren't there. So remote storage and analysis, a trusted computing base can be used to separate information from areas that generate it. And another one is it can be written to a write-once output media to assure against subsequent corruption or destruction. Low-profile buildings. I guess there was a lot of work on this mostly in the 60s, right, when students were invading and doing mean things to real high-profile buildings. Basically, you know, the World Trade Center was real high-profile, and that's probably why they bombed it. If it was in some blockhouse in New Jersey, they probably would have found some other target. So avoid becoming a target. Computer centers located in remote areas. Undistinctive but unmarked buildings for backup storage and blockhouses for storing valued information. It's not an inherently complex thing to do, but a lot of companies have their computer rooms as display cases. Okay, so if you're using your computer room as a display case, you're risking something in the process, and the managers should be identified that if they want beautiful flashing lights, you'll make them a beautiful flashy light panel and move the computer over somewhere else. Minimizing traffic in work areas. For example, the separation of areas by partitions, separated workers on different tasks into different areas, and architecting floor and building areas to control the flow of people is useful because it reduces the opportunity for physical access. And by reducing the opportunity, you're making it harder to accidentally or intentionally get to stuff. Placing equipment and supplies out of harm's way is essentially the same concept done a different way. Like you put computer rooms in areas that are not generally accessible by visitors. You put them in desks with covers between them and passers-by. You wire under floors and over ceilings. And you put supplies in a supply area. It's not a hard thing to do. And if you do it well, it really helps eliminate things. The universal use of badges. Identification badges helps to make it harder for people to do illicit things without being detected. There are electromagnetic badges that automatically open locked areas and they'll allow you to be tracked around the building. There are smart card badges that include electronic authentication information, and the more common physical badges, which use color, format, seals, and similar authenticating information to assert their authenticity. Badging technology can get quite complicated, depending on what your control requirements are and how you're trying to implement those controls, what part the badge plays in that. I should go back on this one and tell you a very brief story about the Department of Energy's new badging system. The Department of Energy used to have a badging system with different colors, you know, like red, green, and blue or something, whatever the colors were. So you could tell somebody wearing a red badge a mile away, say, hey, that person's not trusted. Don't give them information. Now, in order to prevent discrimination against people with different clearances, our trusty ex-secretary decided to change it so everybody has the same colored badge. So now you can't tell what the clearances of the person without looking. You have to get real close. People like me, I don't have that good eyesight anymore. You got to really look up. Excuse me there, Dave. I can talk to you. Doesn't work in a crowded room. So one of the things that's very useful in badging technologies is bright colors to indicate people with different clearances and stripings and other such things so that you can tell who you're allowed to talk to and when somebody's in the room that's not supposed to be there. And when somebody's looking over your shoulder and their badge is the wrong color, you're a lot more careful about what you do. Controlling physical access, restrictions on who can get to what and where and when. For example, gates that require identification for entry and limited access times for different personnel, use of time locks on safes, and secure areas for storage of materials are all other ways to control physical access. Separation of equipment. This is different from keeping the equipment out of harm's way. It means you keep equipment separated from other equipment so that local events don't cause damage across the board. For example, off-site storage facilities. Okay? Physically distributed processing capabilities. Hot sites for operation during natural disasters and similar events. It's actually mandated in a lot of cases by regulation, especially between different classification levels. It can be a complicated issue because of emanations traveling between things if the separations are relatively small. But in the case of things like natural disaster, physical diversity is very important. Large distances, of course, that induces time and other similar problems. When you have to fly all 5,000 of your employees across the country in order to use the backup computers over there, it might cost you more than the outage would have cost you in the first place. Inspection of all incoming and outgoing materials is used, for example, to assure that corruption and leakage isn't taking place. Look for incoming Trojan horses and incoming hardware, for example. Bomb detection at entry points. Improperly cleansed material being sent out of the facility. It's a fairly complex area. There's a great deal of expertise involved. There's a lot of physical security knowledge. Sometimes incomplete or obsolete data is used, like replay attacks. So you want to find a way to suppress those things. So accidental or intentional abuse, databases that remove old records. For example, record-keeping processes that expunge data after statutory or business requirements end. So you automatically delete the old stuff. You know, whether they ask Oliver North, you know, about shredding the documents, he said, well, hey, the government wouldn't have given me a shredder if I wasn't supposed to shred documents. What do you think it was there for? And, you know, which I guess means it shouldn't give people shredders. The destruction of old criminal records by government when appropriate. And it turns out that tracking obsolescence is not that easy to do, and it's rarely done very well. But if it's properly done, it's not hard to have an effective process. Document and information control procedures. Whenever you have sensitive information and it's sent or received, you typically have a procedure used to confirm the action with the other party. For example, receipts for information, non-repudiation services in networks, an advance notice of inbound message. Hey, Joe, I'm going to send you this package. You should have it tomorrow by 10 in the morning, otherwise call me. 10 o'clock in the morning, he hasn't called me. I call Joe. I say, hi, Joe, you get it? I got it. Thank you. Okay, this is just standard operating procedure. When I send a document to somebody, I tell them ahead of time it's coming, get their verification they're going to be there to receive it, and verify that they have received it once they've received it. Should be standard practice for anything of import. Polygraphing. Basically testing to determine the likelihood of the veracity of information. For example, the standard polygraph tests, which I guess are not admissible in court, but they still work. You know, that's how several of those spies got caught, you know. They're, oh, no, if you can't prove it in court, I don't have to. Internal consistency checking is another one. You know, verification of statements with collaborating information, right? When people tell you things, don't just believe it. Call up their ex-boss and ask them about the such and such. Gee, you know, Joe's trying to come to work here, and he said that he worked on the blah, blah, blah project. Is that right? The blah, blah, blah project. Oh, yeah. That project. yeah, Joe had this idea. He wrote it on a piece of paper. He handed it to me. I told him I didn't think it was a very good idea. We didn't do it. Well, that's the blah, blah, blah project. Okay, so try and get collaborating information. It's always it's a different version of polygraphing. Clear line of responsibility for protection is one of the things that organizations seem to lack in great quantity. For example, executive-level responsibility for overall information asset protection is implicitly there, but very rarely explicitly there. Delineated responsibility at every level of the organization is necessary in order to... people like to point fingers at each other, and it's very handy in an organization to say nobody's responsible, but that also means that protection is likely to be ineffective. And spelled-out responsibilities for individual accountability. And the challenge here is substantial, and it mostly has to do with getting people involved and understanding the process and oriented properly. And the hardest thing in information protection, in my experience, is changing the way the organization thinks and operates, not the technology. Non-state retaining devices. There are a variety of devices that do not retain state information beyond sessions, and they're used to provide low-cost periods processing. And I'll tell you about periods processing a little bit later. But basically, like a diskless workstation, you say you reboot it, you don't have to worry about who was on it last, ostensibly. Processing nodes in a lot of parallel processors. There are a lot of parallel processing machines that are essentially used in a period processing mode. The processors themselves have little or no memory, and there's some reset mechanism to clear them out for the next process. And resettable memory areas in multi-state processors. With careful design, you can do that, but in a lot of cases, there's state information that's retained anyway. For example, there's the what is it? Instead of using ROMs in machines now, they use they do use EEPROMs, but after EEPROMs, what's the next one? Sorry? Flash memory. You know flash memory? Flash memory is memory that retains its state, but you can actually change it. So, and there are a whole set of PCs out there that use flash memory to hold the BIOS. And if you're clever, you can reprogram the flash memory so the BIOS causes the machine to halt. So when the machine boots up, it halts. Turns out, the only thing you can do about it is pull out the flash memory, which is typically soldered in. So I can write, a program that comes in over the internet, breaks into your computer, and causes it to crash permanently. You need hardware replacement to fix it. Okay? So that's an example of something that's used that retains state and has memory that's in many machines, but you may not think of as being part of the state of the machine. How about the clock? You can encode information in the clock of a machine by setting the time. And there's all sorts of ways to do it. But you can do it right if you try. Protection of names of resources. Names and other identifying information is not revealed. For example, keeping the employee phone book and organizational chart from being released for those who might abuse its content. Hi, this is a classic. There was this NCSA, I think, published at, what's the name of the guy? It used to be at SAIC. He published a study where they went into corporations and essentially said, oh, I was just hired by the new vice president of such and such, who hadn't yet shown up. He was hired. It was announced that he was hired, but he hadn't shown up yet. So this guy claims that he was hired by so-and-so, and I need to do such and such before he comes. As a prelude to his coming through, I need to go see the company and get all this stuff. They start handing him information. He was able to get account numbers and everything for purchase orders and a cryptographic modem so he could log in through the firewall and authorization to move $1 million here and there and like that. And all because he could figure out the name of somebody and the name of some related people in the organization, so he could play name dropping with various people and get his way. Keeping file names and machine names containing confidential data confidential to make them harder to find is worthwhile. Just operation security. Keeping the names of clients, projects, and other operational information confidential to prevent its exploitation. In large part, the effects of data aggregation affect this, and that's a complicated issue and one of the reasons that it's maybe less well understood than we wish. We need to make sure we comply with laws and regulations, for example, software copyright laws, antitrust laws, regulations applying to the separation of information between traders and investment dealers, advisors, etc. And, of course, the complexity of our legal system is legend, but nevertheless, we need to do that along the way. Legal agreements are one of our tools. For example, insurance contracts relating to information assets. You have employee contracts that specify employee responsibility and punishment for noncompliance. Vendor and outsourcing agreements that specify specific requirements for them and the ability, for example, to audit them, et cetera. And as I mentioned before, the complexity of our legal system is legend. Try and get your corporate attorney to change the contract with Microsoft to say that you can expect their facilities to make sure that they have security. And then see how many Microsoft products you get. Rescue devices. Special devices used to provide emergency recovery capabilities, like rescue diskettes used to recover from disk crashes and root file system failures, and emergency codes used to indicate entry under duress. And media destroying media cases. Right? I have a special case for holding this disk that if I open it the wrong way, it destroys the disk. So, I don't have to worry about chaining it to my wrist. If they want it, they can have it. Thank you. Goodbye. And I don't actually know how to open it. So the guy at the other end knows how to open it, so go to it. There are a lot of technologies existing for this. Many of the devices are also usable for the attack side.